This is a really fantastic episode of Fresh Bites on the Bitey End of the Dog, as I have the opportunity to chat with Lorenzo J.W. Fox from Synergy Behavior Solutions. Lorenzo brings into the conversation a diverse background in not only animal behavior, but an investment into mutual aid, abolition, and liberation for humans and animals. This all blends together for a great chat about relationships between humans and dogs, and consent-based training as well. And don't forget about the Aggression in Dogs conference happening from September 30th through October 2nd, 2022 in Providence, Rhode Island, with both in-person and online options. You can learn about the conference as well as the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, which is the most comprehensive course available anywhere in the world for learning how to work with and help dogs with aggression issues by going to aggressivedog.com. And if you are interested in hearing more about applicable, tangible, and immediate steps you can use with your own dog, or in your cases, check out the subscription series I just launched, which is an additional format to this podcast, where I walk you through a variety of aggression issues and how to solve them. You'll find a little subscribe button on Apple Podcasts where the Bitey End of the Dog show is listed. Your support of the show is very much appreciated. Hey everyone, I'm here with Lorenzo J.W. Fox, who is an animal trainer with Synergy Behavior Solutions, a veterinary behavior and training facility located in Portland, Oregon. Working for almost a decade with behavioral kids and teens in juvenile justice, public education, wilderness therapy, and domestic violence shelters for 10 years, and after growing up on a working farm and exotic animal petting zoo, this all culminated in a fixation and passion for play as therapy, rehabilitation, and relationship consent-based interactions, and a holistic approach to resolving complex and challenging behavioral struggles. Lorenzo is a co-founder of Force Free Oregon and remains invested in work related to mutual aid, abolition, and liberation for humans and animals. Lorenzo is a 2022 instructor for Whole Dog Academy. They live in Portland, Oregon with three dogs, four tarantulas, an Asian cockatiel, and a very large boa constrictor. Welcome to the show, Lorenzo. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mike.
And you are joining us from a very busy veterinary behavior practice, so you'll hear maybe some action going on in the background, but that is the nature of being busy and working full-time in this kind of industry. So we're going to jump into a topic that, again, needs to be talked about more often in the animal training and behavior community, which is, you know, the relationship aspect of training. Because in the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of focus on behaviorism and, you know, identifying antecedents and consequences, which is, of course, a very important part of our work. But sometimes we lose sight of the relationship aspects. And Lorenzo, you come from a very unique background of understanding many aspects of the human dynamic in these cases. So I'd love to just kind of jump right in and talk about, you know, some of the, let's start off maybe on the topic of choice and control and some of these new catchphrases, and I wouldn't necessarily call them new because they've always existed for animals, but in dog training especially, we're seeing choice and control, agency, you know, ability to act on the environment, all those aspects come in, and how they have an application or implication in our relationships with animals. So do you want to expand further on that first?
Yeah, so I agree with you that there's definitely this focus on, you know, a lot of conversation around things like ABA, et cetera. And just like as an aside, in terms of, I think that the conversations are pretty emotionally charged and very different when it comes to conversations with ABA around people and kids versus animals. And I've sort of been like in pretty like deep into both of those worlds historically, and the perspective is really different. But one thing that I think is really salient to me is the fact that one of the things that I focus on a lot working in DV shelters and like trauma-informed care, especially working with kids who experience like complex and ongoing psychological trauma, was, you know, this concept of like attachment theory, which is really just around different levels of disorganized attachment versus secure attachment, what might be classified as like unhealthy attachment. Attachment is basically just the ability of a young organism to feel really just like physically and emotionally safe with their caregiver. But a really important part of that, which I see play out a ton in behavior modification, and that's when I say behavior modification, I'm talking about the work that we do at Synergy when working with like pretty like emotionally charged behaviors. So we like specialize in things like fears and phobias and aggressive behaviors. So we don't really do a whole lot or really any like sit down, stay type training here. And so when I'm thinking behavior modification, we're talking about situations where most often the learner, in this case, the animal, doesn't feel safe. And so for my purposes, if I'm looking at a dog handler team, the history of the relationship and the ability of the animal to feel safe in that relationship, so essentially their like attachment history and the health of that attachment, really impacts the animal's choice in the moment and whether or not they are going to feel safe enough to, obviously that like impacts whether or not they're going to be exhibiting aggressive behavior or fear behaviors, but it also impacts their ability to learn to make different choices. And so a lot of what I teach my students when working with like reactivity and aggression is around training for the moment, not in the moment. So a lot of old school dog training was really about like putting the dog in the stressful situation and then, you know, like correcting them or even trying to like distract them with food for like some of the kind of more rudimentary or simplistic kind of trying to be force-free perspectives, which obviously are not super effective long-term. But training for the moment means like building the skills and self-regulation necessary outside of the situation that is stressful. But then as we feel like the animal has like built those skills, which as we do those processes and play those games, we're also like investing in the attachment and the relationship. But then as we start to expand the animal's world and start to introduce like lower levels of stressors and start to reintroduce access to the situations that were challenging before, that's where we really get to see the history of the relationship impacting the present choice that the animal is making. And so I think it is really important that we are always providing as much choice as possible within reason, prioritizing like the safety of the learner, but also the people and animals around them. But if that healthy relationship and the antecedent really of the healthy attachment with the handler isn't there, especially given that dogs are really fundamentally aware all the time of how, you know, at our mercy they really are, especially when they're attached to a leash, then that's where we really get to see whether or not the animal is feeling comfortable enough to go out into the world and to try and make choices and to try and engage with the world in a different way and to try to utilize and like practice these new skills while still being able to return to the caregiver for that sense of safety and that anchor. And so if that's what attachment is, like when a 2-year-old-ish child has a healthy attachment, that means that in a new environment, they're able to move away from their caregiver, explore a little bit, and then if they get spooked or worried, they can always return for that reassurance. If the animal isn't feeling that sense of comfort, then we're not going to get the exploring or we're not going to get that return to like recharge and feel safe again. So we're getting an animal that is going to be like dysregulated and the learning isn't taking place. So I think the biggest struggle with that, with seeing that play out, is that if you don't recognize that dynamic happening, that's where we get the positive reinforcement doesn't work, or I tried treats and it didn't work. But if we look at the dynamic of the relationship, it's that you pushed into a scary situation too quickly before you had the animal trusting and feeling safe in at least like the whatever like bubble of security you should have created in order for them to be able to explore the world that at this point they've decided is not super safe, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you bring up many very important points there, especially, you know, when you're talking about this attachment theory and sort of a trust-based approach in that the animal feels safe with their handler. And it's obviously you're drawing on some of the parallel experiences you had working with children and how much of that is similar with dog handlers or dog owners and their dogs that are having issues in certain environments. So can you talk about specific maybe things to look for to kind of be aware of that? So maybe an owner's listening right now and saying, oh, well, I don't know. Does my dog trust me in that kind of sense? Or is there this attachment where they're going to feel safe in a particular environment?
So for guardians that are wondering like, oh, okay. So this opens up a whole other question of if we're thinking about ABC, antecedent behavior consequence. I was just talking to a client about this actually like an hour ago. Sometimes I think it can feel overwhelming when I start talking to my client about like, yeah, so I know that you think it's like my dog sees a dog, starts lunging and barking, dog equals lunging and barking. But it's not just like we think that's the salient antecedent, but the antecedents are actually infinite, right? Like we could make a list that goes on and on and on. And the antecedents for our behavior are also infinite and often not like we're not aware of them. And just as an aside, I think this is significant and at least for me important in my process and journey with my own dogs and trying to understand them. And my dogs make me a better person, and wanting to be a better trainer makes me a better person, I think. And so part of that process is like examining my own antecedents, especially for my knee-jerk assumptions and biases and like judgments about people and situations. And so a lot of the things that impact that are going to be things like my privilege and systems of oppression, etc. And a lot of that is stuff that people aren't aware of when they're interacting with other people just day to day. And so that's something that I'm trying to cultivate in my own self-awareness all the time. And so the way that, that something like that would translate for my dog is thinking about not only, you know, their learning environment, genetics, and self, their legs, as Kim Brophy would say, but also like the way that the trigger picture in that moment and each element of it is influenced in that dynamic. So for example, the client that I was just seeing, this really beautiful and lovely Australian Labradoodle who was honestly an incredible temperament dog compared to most of the dogs that I see, who had been incredible for like 3 years and then got pretty viciously attacked several times by other dogs and was finally traumatized enough that she was like, I lunge and bark at other dogs now, especially in my neighborhood and pretty intensely and totally understandably. And the wife had been, you know, she's been working really hard with the dog and taking her out, you know, trying to, you know, we ditched the walks for a month or so to work on some foundation skills. And then she'd been getting out and doing some practice with the dog and was still struggling a little bit. So I, we've been doing virtual training. So she came in for their first in-person session. And she said, well, my husband took her out yesterday and he refuses to take treats and refuses to do any of the training games, which is fairly typical. Although often not at our level of training, because a lot of the time when people get to Synergy, they're like pretty desperate sometimes. And so usually everybody's like all in, but sometimes it still happens. And but he took the dog somewhere she'd never really been. And it was it's a very busy area of Portland. And it's actually like a pretty big like touristy shopping area. And it was a nice sunny day. So he sat with her outside of a cafe and they were passed by people and dogs, dog after dog after dog. And she, I think she barked like once. And so he told himself all these stories about why that was the case. And I think it was hard for her to hear. Like she felt good about it, but she was also frustrated because she was like, why does she always react when I take her out? And I was like, well, it's because you always take her out and you are always there. And so you are a generalized picture of so many different situations that she's had that were scary. You are part of that antecedent more than he is because he doesn't interact with her as much. But also, in that neighborhood, her relationship with each of the dogs that she would see every single day that she had really charged relationships with are going to impact each of the moments that she sees them. And those layers continue to build. Whereas these dogs in this situation that she'd never rehearsed these behaviors in are, she's like, I've never barked at any dogs on this street, so I don't bark at dogs on this street. And that's not true for all dogs. I think like my dog would certainly bark at, my dog, aggressive dog, would bark at any dog on any street, really, at least historically. But in this situation, she was a dog that actually is pretty dog social. And so when, this is kind of like a tangential way of coming back to this idea of like, we have to look at all of the elements that are going to be like repeatedly coming together and what are the like most common denominators that keep popping up within that particular trigger picture. And so the most common denominator is usually your relationship with your dog. And if you notice, I think you've probably noticed a lot, people come to us saying like, well, why is my dog very active when I walk him, but not when my wife walks him? And these aren't, I think the relationship, sure, like there are different types of relationships that we have with dogs, but it often is more about like what sort of behaviors have been rehearsed and what sort of behaviors are being rehearsed in the house too. Like what sort of, who plays with the dog, who does training games with the dog, who feeds the dog, what sort of interactions and tiny little moments, you know, if a healthy relationship is just a history of positive reinforcement, every single interaction that you have with that dog, you can be dropping a coin into that relationship bank account. And then the more that that bank account is invested in, the more like money that we have in it, the more that we can withdraw from it or that we can count on it when we need it. And the times that we need it are the moments that our dog knows that they are vulnerable, and the most vulnerable they feel often when we're talking about like aggressive or reactive dogs is going to be in the end of a leash when they see the thing that they're most worried about. So that can be, for most of my clients, a challenging like mental hurdle that they have to overcome is that I'm often the first trainer that says to them, like, I would like for you to stop walking your dog. And that's difficult for people to hear a lot, but really, if they can stay home for a while and just invest in that relationship bank account, and fortunately, I give them 3 or 4 games that not only are going to be building those foundation skills that they eventually take out into the world in the presence of other dogs or people, whatever and their dog's trigger might be, but on top of that, every single time they interact with their dog, they can be investing in that relationship bank account. And our dogs determine what is a positive interaction, right? And usually their behavior, as simple as it is, will tell us if that was something that was an investment or a withdrawal.
What do you say to people that say, well, it's really just about learning experiences and really has nothing to do with the relationship, or vice versa, maybe some other extremes where it's somebody, oh, the dog's just protecting me, or the dog is just resource guarding me, or, you know, so you hear sort of opposite extremes where, you know, some are saying, oh, it has nothing to do with the relationship. They can't sense your energy or read your mind, or, you know, so you have that one aspect.
I mean, I agree. They can't read my mind. I will say that my dog can read me a lot better than I can read them often, but that's, there's a lot of parallels I could draw to that in terms of like whose life and survival depends on them being able to read the person or organism that has more power over them. And that's the case with our dogs. And so, it's not a question of energy. The people are like, oh, like I am, like my husband is just more dominant. But it's like, well, no, it could just be that something that maybe your husband is just more relaxed. Maybe he's not tense like this and he relaxes his arm. And it's not about energy. It's about a dog's reading every single tiny thing we do, because every moment of their existence and every aspect of their survival depends on predicting what is going to happen next and what we're going to do. And like, no time more than when they are physically attached to us by like at the end of a leash. The whole like, is my dog protecting me thing, I am fortunate enough at this point in my career that I don't have to generally have those conversations. Like sometimes they come up, but all my private clients at least have to first have a behavior health assessment with Dr. Bali, our board certified veterinary behaviorist. So she usually has covered that stuff. But I certainly have had those conversations in the past, and I don't really like argue with people about it anymore. I usually am just like, okay, what does that look like? Like describe it. So I think describing behaviors is helpful. And then I usually find it to be helpful to be like, so what about a situation where XYZ? And it might be, they'll be like, oh, she's just protecting me, but she's fine off leash. And I'm like, okay, so you're saying that your dog is protective of you, but only when she's attached to a leash. Why is that? So you can ask those questions. But I think what's more important to me is like, A, like, okay, it doesn't really matter if they believe that. They can continue to believe it as long as they're going to follow the training plan I give them, which usually they figure out pretty quickly through what we're doing that that's not really what's happening. And also you can just ask things like, you know, if they're like, oh, well, I've been doing, you know, I've been letting them know that I'm in charge by putting, you know, them behind me or whatever it is. Then I'm like, how is that working for you? Like the answer is usually not very well because they're here. So I think I can usually say, yes, I can understand why it feels that way. But here's a different explanation. And usually, I was actually thinking about the other day, because I also teach like an online Reactive Rover homeschool class, and my Reactive Rover class is, I think, very different than a lot of Reactive Rover classes. It's definitely different than the Reactive Rover classes I've taken with my reactive dogs, including the one I took at Synergy like 10 years ago before they had a facility and way before I was a dog trainer. But there was this class that I taught, and one of my students, they had a really challenging dog, like an older couple, and they're both disabled in some way, and the wife is actually disabled because of something that happened with the dog, but he wasn't aggressive to her, but it was just like an accident that occurred, and so they were just really old school about it, but they loved the dog and really wanted to try and figure out a way that they could be safe with him, and they tried their best. Connection wasn't great, but they did a good job, and like by that I mean the internet connection, and then at the end of the class, and I wasn't really sure they'd gotten a ton out of it, but they were there every time and trying their best. And then at the end of the class, I got like an email from him, and he said, "Yeah, this class changed my life and changed my perspective on my dog. It was the first time that I realized that my dog is a creature with all of these feelings." And I was like, "Yeah, like we don't think about the emotional life of the animal really super often, and that's." People are like, yeah, of course my dog has feelings, which I think is actually a pretty mainstream. People are like, yes, that's a thing now, because I think Psychology Today has an article about it like every 3 months or something. But but when it comes to those moments where we are making up stories about our dogs, that often actually pushes further away the examination of their emotional life, of like what is actually happening with them right now. And sometimes it just helps to, like, you know how when you're in this situation and they're like, "Oh yeah, that sucks." And you're like, "Well, that's like that for your dog right now."
Yeah. So I'm going to take a quick break, but I'm going to come back and pick your brain more about this relationship aspect, because I want to dig deeper into that. So I'm going to pause for a moment and take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you are enjoying this episode. I have a very special offer that I am announcing just before the Aggression in Dogs conference this year. You've heard me talk about the Aggression in Dogs Master Course on this podcast, and for a limited time to celebrate the third annual conference, I'm going to launch a bundle offer that includes the course and all 14 webinars on aggressivedog.com. Yes, that's all of the webinars. The webinars alone would typically cost more than $450 to purchase together, but I'm including them for free in this special bundle deal with the Aggression in Dogs Master Course. Just some of the topics for the webinars include how to break up a dog fight, dog to cat aggression, dog to child directed aggression, and treat and retreat with some of the most respected behavior pros in our field, including Suzanne Clothier, Jen Shryock, Trish McMillan, and Dr. Jessica Heckman, just to name a few. And the Master Course gives you access to 23 modules on everything from assessment to safety to medical issues to the behavior change plans we use in a number of different cases, including lessons taught by Dr. Chris Pockel, Kim Brophy, and Jessica Dolce. You'll also receive access to a private Facebook group with over 1,000 of your fellow colleagues and dog pros all working with aggression cases. After you finish the course, you gain access to private live group mentor sessions with me, where we practice working through cases together. And if you need CEUs, we've got you covered. We're approved for just about every major training and behavior credential out there. This is truly the flagship course offered on aggression in dogs, and is perfect for pet pros that want to set themselves apart and take their knowledge and expertise to the next level, or even for pet owners who are seeking information to help their own dog. You'll receive all 14 webinars, the master course, mentor sessions, and access to the private Facebook group for all just the price of the master course, which is only $495. There's only going to be 50 bundles available in this offer, and I will drop a link to the bundle in the show notes for this episode. The offer will expire on October 9th, 2022, which is just 1 week after the conference, though the bundle typically sells out quickly, so please take advantage if you are interested. Head on over to the show notes for this episode in the podcast platform you're listening to this episode in, and click on the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and Expert Webinar Bundle link. Thanks again for your support of the show, and I hope to see you in the Master Course. All right, welcome back. I'm here with Lorenzo. We've been talking about relationships in dogs, and especially with aggression cases, how that impacts the behavior. I promised I was going to dig a little deeper into this relationship aspect of things because, you might get the argument, can you operationalize that? Or what does it look like when somebody has that relationship with the dog, or the dog is trusting the owner in a particular aspect? And you mentioned attachment theory, which has come up a couple times in this season's podcast episodes, which is great to see, because we're, again, thinking outside of just the realm of antecedent consequence relationships. So if you were to say, okay, all right, let me actually rephrase that question. I'll say, Lorenzo, tell me what, if you had the perfect client or the perfect example of a dog having the relationship you'd like to see, or maybe they don't have the relationship and you eventually have an outcome or goal for them, what would it look like if you were to spell it out in words, what you're seeing?
So there's two things that come to mind. So the first thing is, often I can get quite a bit out of, the way the person talks about their dog, for sure. One of the silver linings of COVID for sure has been our shift to virtual appointments, which we honestly should have done a really long time ago because of the types of clients that we work with, the types of behaviors. And so starting all of our clients in virtual sessions means that I get to see them theoretically at their best, where the dog is theoretically as relaxed as it could be, as it should be in its home. So its home environment versus coming into the facility, which can be a pretty triggering experience for most of our learners until they have established a level of skill and some foundations of being able to cope with stress. And so, and novelty, novel environments and people, et cetera. So one of the things that I noticed right off the bat is what is their dog doing when they're just sitting there talking to me for the first time? And that's influenced by a lot of factors, of course, but I think that some of the things that I noticed right off the bat in a relatively a more secure attached relationship is that the dog is reasonably calm. So by that, I mean choosing a calm position. So maybe they are sitting or laying down close to the person, maybe touching the person, not necessarily. Maybe they are low to moderate level of arousal, expecting something, especially because there are instructions before they meet with me is to get a bowl of high value treats. So usually for people that have a history of positive reinforcement training with their dog, the dog's like, ooh, that means that there's training happening. So I can usually see that anticipation happening and that learning history. So maybe the dog is offering some behaviors, but ideally not with a super high arousal level. The dogs that are obsessively trying to crawl on their people's faces, the dogs that are not present in the space, the dogs that are, it's pretty rare, but sometimes they are patrolling or reacting the entire time, but that's relatively uncommon. And also the way that the person responds to their dog responding to the environment is usually pretty significant. But I think that probably one of the most important moments is the first time that the person tries to give their dog a treat. So when they try to hand their dog a treat, and to be fair, the very first exercise that we do, I'm asking the person to drop a treat on the floor. But often, depending on, again, the relationship that they have, the person might try to put the treat into the dog's mouth. And I see a lot of dogs that if there's not trust established, and this might be, and this is honestly, yes, I see it in very often in dogs that have a history of aversive training. So dogs that have a history of being trained with prong collars or shock collars or corrections, even if it's so-called balance training, or honestly, especially if it's so-called balance training, because a lot of the time the dog is like, am I going to get the treat or is something terrible going to happen? So you can see that conflict happening. But also with dogs that are trained with what people think are positive reinforcement, I sometimes see more conflict, because sometimes people think that if they're feeding the animal, then it's a positive experience, but that's not necessarily the case. And so the way that they feed the treat is often quite aversive, especially for the types of dogs we work with. And so I'll see dogs that are trying to maintain a bubble from their person, a distance bubble that their person is not aware of. And so they keep crowding the dog and the dog keeps moving away. Or they try to reach the treat out to the dog and the dog steps back, or the dog hesitates before taking the food. They drop the treat on the ground and the dog is unsure about whether or not they're allowed to have it. And I understand that people will talk about default, leave it. And I still don't think that that's the same thing as the dog feeling conflicted. Like you either, if your dog has a default, leave it, then you should also have clarity around whether or not they're allowed to have the thing. So if you've told them they should have, they can have the thing, they should know they can have the thing. So if they still are uncertain and there's some conflict there and there's a lack of communication. So just like small things like that. And then of course like body language. And I take into account also the fact that a lot, like way more, and I know that you've talked about this on the show, but way more of the dogs than people realize that we see come to us with undiagnosed chronic pain and illness that are contributing to their behavior. And often I see that like right off the bat in their behavior. So tucked tail or like moving strangely, which some trainers might perceive as the dog being frightened or whatever. Like I also see it as like, I think that dog is uncomfortable. But that also contributes to their relationship with the person for sure. So I think it's really small things. And when they first come into the facility for the first time, dogs that are confident enough to check out the space a little bit while also acknowledging their person. So looking at their person, making sure they're aware, like, are they still there? Okay, good. And then continuing to check out the space. Dogs that are willing to like relax and lay down in the space is a really big deal. That's pretty uncommon though for the first time that they're here. Dogs that are even just willing to take food from their person in the space. Just small things like that, I think, is a really big indicator of relationship. And I also don't go into any of those interactions making assumptions based on the dog's learning history and training history, because I've seen both ends of the spectrum. And definitely if you have used aversive training tools, it's a lot more likely that your dog is not quite certain about how that interaction is going to, if it's going to be pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah, and some additional, lots of things to unpack there. So many great points. And one of the aspects I was thinking about is that to make for some of the bullet points, I guess we could call them, is for like the relationship aspect to be healthy and to be something that the dog can, that we're going to be able to help the dog with in their, you know, when we're working with aggression or issues of behavior that we want to change is consistency and clarity, as well as recognizing when the dog is communicating to us when they are not okay with a certain situation, and then what we do. Because one of the questions I get, you know, I'm sure you get this all the time, is, you know, is it my fault? Is it something I'm doing? And, you know, I never say, come on, say, well, yeah, it's your fault. No. Because everybody really is trying the best they can with the mm-hmm. information they have most of the time, because they're reaching out to you for behavior help or training. And so most people are trying, you know, they're not purposely trying to create issues for themselves. The rare cases you could say, well, yeah, you should probably stop doing whatever you're doing there right away. But vast majority of cases, you know, it's this issue of not knowing what to do because they're getting conflicting information from all these places, which then translates to what we're telling our dogs and how we're communicating with our dogs. So yeah, consistency, clarity, being predictable, knowing that it's safe in the environment. Do you see it happening? You had mentioned some things that can backfire on you. So we know about things like we might call poisoning food or using food in a coercive way. So using an appetitive stimulus in an incorrect way can spoil the relationship. But do you see it going to, you had mentioned some extremes, but if it's kind of going the other way. So you're coaching your clients on trying to focus on repairing or building a relationship, but then you might have other cases where there's an extreme of kind of the opposite. So they're doing too many things and they're creating much, you know. So can you give me an example case of that or what that would look like?
I feel like most of the recommendations that I give people is to stop doing a lot of things. And I think that's really just because, like, we're talking about a lifestyle. We're talking about often trying to shift the lifetime with the dog. And that's not to say that people are doing everything wrong. It's that they're trying so many things, because a lot of people are, I don't want to say the word is desperate, but they care about their dog. They care about their relationship. They're really invested in it. And a lot of, there's so many people, their neighbor and their neighbor's uncle and the guy on TV, et cetera, and every Google search they've done, that's telling them to do something different. And this is like a separate issue, but I've been talking to trainers about it recently, is there's so many trainers that I know who give their clients advice that they themselves would never do. It's like, you know, they're like, you have to do X, Y, Z, and also here's 14,000 things. And the person's like, I can't do that. And they're like, oh, well, and I, like, I wouldn't do that. Like, that's not going to work in my life. And I have ADHD and a variety of other concerns in my life that I'm like, there's no way that I would be able to implement that training program. So if I wouldn't be able to do it, and I'm a professional who spends all day thinking about behavior in dogs, then my client can't. So, like, a couple things on what you said is, like, one is, yeah, absolutely, I never would blame a client for their dog's behavior, especially because every client and student that I have is there, absolutely, they're trying their best. And I don't care what they've done in the past, they are here now. And I always will meet them where they're at, and I'll go to the ends of the earth for a client. However, I do not feel that way about other trainers, because all the information is available to them, and they can access it at any time for free. But regardless, I also feel that that kind of grace, if I extend that to my clients, that is also how I can model that so they can extend it to their dogs. Because we need to be able to meet the dog where they're at also. And sometimes that means moving a lot slower for the dog so that the person can catch up. So, for example, if I have a client that historically I'd use a lot of aversive tools, and I'm like, okay, well, I see that your dog is like I have a client right now with a dog that's very large dog that is exhibiting very intense and lifelong, he's like six now, intentional, like intent to harm, aggression toward people, like all people, everybody except for his two humans. And he's been walked on a prong collar forever. And I know it's contributing to his aggressive behavior, but their ability to feel safe being attached to him and working with him is a big part of that. And I'm not going to tell them they have to remove it until they feel comfortable and safe enough to do so, because that's the only way that this relationship is going to continue right now. And so, what we're going to continue to work at the pace that those people need. And that might also mean, like, hey, now we're really going to try to scale back the exposure that this animal is receiving to an extent so that we're not continuing to perpetuate and rehearse that behavior within that dynamic. And so in terms of, like, asking people to do less, for the most part, people are relieved to hear that. When I finally convince them they don't need to feel guilty about not walking their dog, it's usually a massive relief. I give people 3-minute games. And that means that usually it is less than 10 full minutes of training a day of actual, like, take some food and train. We do a lot of environmental management and reframing of the dog's behavior that really, really helps. And a lot of, like, I really like to use, I've been using, utilizing a lot of affection and physical touch as a primary reinforcer. And the way that I do it is, like, based on Rosales Ruiz's constructional affection, but I also have, like, a conditioning protocol that's front loaded before we actually utilize it in any other situation. And the front loading is, the homework is basically, like, sit in a quiet room with your dog for 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes, like, set a timer, no food, no toys, nothing except you and your dog, and just pet them. And almost every, my clients are like, you just want me to, like, pet my dog. I'm like, absolutely. And I have, like, a specific way that I ask them to do it. But for most of them, after just a few weeks, just that interaction of, like, just sitting and being with them and having that physical touch, which is just, like, people need that to survive. Like, dogs are social animals who also need touch to survive and to feel good and for emotional regulation. It's amazing how calming it is. And it starts to condition, like, physiological relaxation in the animal, because even for my chronically over-aroused dogs, that's at least 15 minutes a day that they're truly relaxing, and we're getting, like, lowered heart rate and lowered respiratory rate, and that that, like, reciprocal, you know, like, bioregulation happening between the two creatures is, like, super cool, and it absolutely, like, massively fills that relationship bank account. And it can be, like, as simple as that, that we can start to, like, move forward. And when I like reintroduce walks, when we start to do that again for the dogs that are ready, a lot of it is to, like, slow down and stop and let their dog think and process and then let them respond to what their dog is telling them. And I think the, like, hey, like, stop telling your dog what to do and just listen for a moment. And that can also, like, dramatically change the walk, like, in an instant. So I think it's nice for people to like, kind of get out of their heads a little bit and what they think is supposed to be happening, and just, like, stop trying to get your dog's attention and just stand there and wait. It usually goes pretty well.
So, many big takeaways from everything you were saying there. One of the things is that, you know, we have to respect the needs of each unique individual, whether it's the animal or the human that we're working with. But sometimes what's best is to actually do training is to not do any training, right? And just kind of work on the relationship aspect and let life be without so being focused on all of the things that we're thinking of, you know, in terms of changing animal behavior. Sometimes it's just a matter of not doing so much focusing on those things in certain points of the day. So I have one additional question for you. You know, again, based on your background and your interests in things like mutual aid, abolition, liberation, and how that parallels with the work you're doing now, because I think you have a unique perspective and insight in that regard to talk about, you know, the work you're doing with dogs and how that's influenced what you're doing. So do you want to expand on that a little bit further?
Yeah, so I'm a fairly like outspoken abolitionist when it comes to like abolishing and deconstructing white supremacy and our prison system. It's not something that I necessarily think is going to happen in my lifetime, but deconstructing and starting to one day live in a world that doesn't have the like inherent power dynamics that impact every single moment of our existence. This is also, you know, I think these conversations, you know, I'm grateful that they've really come into the mainstream since, you know, summer of 2020. But I was also like raised in a family that was really dedicated to this. So like my grandfather was like inducted into the Kentucky Civil Rights Hall of Fame and spent marched with Martin Luther King Jr. And so and my mom is a feminist sociology professor and Marxist. And so I spent a lot of time talking about these things from a really young age. So one of the things that I have been thinking about a lot since I transitioned to like working in behavior, and especially since I think very naturally came to force-free training, which I didn't start. I actually hired a Barkbusters trainer when my dog Summer was 11. So that's like a whole other thing, but pretty quickly transitioned to positive reinforcement training. But I think there's always been this like incongruency and like trying to understand, like, just because we're using the positive reinforcement quadrant, it still didn't feel like that was force-free. So what is like punishment in the, and I think you've talked about this before also, like the sort of like social and colloquial understanding of punishment versus what it, you know, the behavioral science definition. But I think that there's also this like other space of it. And that is the way that it is built into our capitalist system and into a system of white supremacy that is based on exploitation, but is also based on, we're like obsessed with punishment at every single level of our society. And there was a tweet that was like written in 2020 that's been like seared into my brain that was like, you know, we're never going to really grapple with racism and white supremacy until we grapple with our obsession with punishment. And that's really true. And it rings true, I think, you know, in a way that a lot of trainers in the force-free community don't want to examine, because it really does mean examining the way that we treat other people. And that's not just in our micro interactions and our day-to-day interactions, but also the way that every single choice that we make is impacting people that we often work really hard to not see and not be aware of. So understanding power dynamics and like even just starting to unpack them is, I think, essential to us being better trainers and to also being better caregivers. And, you know, Patricia McConnell would say like benevolent leaders for our dogs. And also like the truth is that like dogs are our captives, and we shouldn't like, but ultimately there is no way to have an equitable relationship with them. And so I think that is also true in our relationships with other humans. If we continue in the system that we are in, there is no way to have like a capitalist exploitative system and then try and have equitable relationships with people, especially like I am a white person, white Latinx, but I'm still white. And that means that even if I am actively anti-racist and try every single day to contribute to dismantling white supremacy, I'm not only benefiting from it all the time, but I'm also just perpetuating it all of the time. And that doesn't mean that we need to walk around being like overcome with guilt, although honestly, white people should feel bad and we should be working hard to like counteract that and to be actively anti-racist. But I think that if we if we as trainers that like want to be force free and really want to talk about not intentionally causing pain and fear, we have to be grappling with that on a societal level also, or else we're really just doing performative stuff. And sure, it's like easy to talk about that in relationship with a cute dog, but also it's easy to do that with the dog because we are still completely in control of everything about that animal. We want to say that we can't control people in that way, but we do every single day because we get to benefit from the system that is controlling their lives and determining their outcome in so many ways that they have no power over. So I think that's a conversation that is starting to happen, and people are pretty resistant to it. And I think that is Audre Lorde that said, like, you know, the political is personal and the personal is political. And I'm pretty wary of anyone who wants to say that, like, there's no place for politics in dog training, because it's just patently untrue. And it's also the same way that I feel about people who say that they're, like, just not that into politics. I'm like, that must be nice for you, because, like, as a trans person right now, if you are not even remotely aware of the literal and very violent attack on trans kids happening right now in almost every single state, it's like pretty terrifying, and it's literally going to lead to like a lot of death. I would argue that it's like pretty close to genocide because of the high rates of suicide for trans kids and trans teens. So I think, like, yeah, we do need to talk about politics and the way that power influences our ability to have choice and to make sure that we are giving and allowing space for all people and all living things to make as much choice as they can in order to feel safe, both like emotionally and physically. And we're definitely not going to achieve that with animals if we can't even try to extend it with people. It's just not going to happen.
You bring up so many salient points that we could literally have an entire whole show on that, of course. And I really appreciate you opening up and talking about those things, because you are right. They're not talked about enough. But I'm also glad to see these topics being brought up in the dog training community and the need. And you mentioned not separating politics or not, and when you think about it, dog training community is probably the most political,
with
regards to training methods. So it's something that is already occurring. We just have to obviously talk about, you know, things that are probably even much more important than.
It's messy. It's not an easy conversation. But the same people who don't want to talk about racism and white supremacy are the same people who are calling for regulations and dog training. So it's like, come on, like, you can't have it both ways. But yes, I also have commented to many people, and one of the reasons I wanted to come on your podcast, and I appreciate the fact that you have always been like vocal about those things and have not tried to shut down those conversations, and been like pretty open and humble and expressive about the need for them. So I really appreciate that about you.
No, I appreciate you. So Lorenzo, tell me or tell the listeners where they can find you and more information about what you're up to.
So I, for the last couple of years, was like running pretty much every day, posting on the Synergy Behavior Solutions Instagram and Facebook. So I've done a ton of write-ups for the blog and for the social media on a variety of topics, a lot of the stuff that I talked about today. I also have done a ton of lives on their live talks about a lot of these topics and demos with my own dogs. You can find me on Instagram at LorenzoJW_X. However, that's mostly me ranting about politics. If you want to learn about my dogs, that's going to be Summer and Yoshi and Rufio, all separated by underscores. You can also follow the Whole Dog Academy. I will be teaching their Dogs in Society course this year. That's a local dog trainer certification class school here in Portland. And a bunch of other really fantastic instructors in that school. Yeah, I train at Synergy Behavior Solutions, and I also teach for Plucky Puppy, which is a local puppy training company, just like class on the weekends. I used to teach for them before I worked for Synergy. Yeah, I think that's it.
Excellent. Fantastic. I'll be sure to link all of those links in the show notes.
Thank you.
Lorenzo, thank you again for coming on. I really appreciate all of your insight and expertise, and I hope to see you again in the future.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
What a fabulous conversation I had with Lorenzo. They brought such interesting insight into the conversation, and I hope to hear from Lorenzo more in the future. I'd also love to hear what you'd like for additional topics in future episodes of both the Bitey End of the Dog and the Help for Dogs with Aggression subscription series. You can reach out by emailing podcast@aggressivedog.com. That's podcast@aggressivedog.com. I would love to hear from you, and I thank you for tuning into the show. Stay well, my friends. Thanks for joining me for the Bitey End of the Dog. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, and give a rating. And hop on over to aggressivedog.com or theloosleashacademy.com for more information about webinars, courses, and conferences, all dedicated to helping dogs with aggression issues. And don't forget, the Aggression and Dogs Conference will be happening from October 22nd to 24th with 12 amazing speakers, all streaming from a television studio in Chicago. It's going to be a truly unique event in 2021.